The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
We're so glad you've stopped by. Welcome to Around the World in a Glass, presented by Sportsman's with your host, Kimber Stonehouse. Come indulge with us in the next hour as we explore a region of the world, its wine and spirits. We'll also talk about food, tours, and other amenities unique to this area. Sit back and enjoy. Now, here's Kimber Stonehouse.
Well, hello, and welcome back to Around the World in a Glass. I am here, actually physically in the studio today, so hopefully you enjoyed last week's rerun, or encore, maybe is a nicer way to say that, with the little bit of Italian thing that I did a few months back. I have been on my vacation, wine trip, whatever you want to call it. It was a little bit of everything, so it was absolutely fantastic. So I am back from France. I have been and come back. I brought back a wee little cold from Paris. So I didn't think that was very nice of the Parisians to pass off one of their colds. But I brought it back to Phoenix with me, amongst some other fun souvenirs. And I handed it off late last week, most of it anyway. So I sound a little raspy or not quite the same. I'm still fighting the little residual effects of that little cold. But that's why we did the encore last week of the Italian way. I was a little under the weather and I couldn't stop coughing, and I didn't think you all wanted to listen to that, to be quite honest. So my trip to France was absolutely amazing. And if you live in France, and you listen, that's awesome. You have amazing wine there. And I am going to talk a little bit about my trip, partly from an American perspective, because here in the States, we have some misconceptions, I believe, about French people, and are often told or often given the impression that the French people don't like us. And, you know, and I have to tell you that my friend who is also in the wine industry and I, who made up our own tour, okay, so we didn't go on anything organized or structured. We're both a little bohemian, so we just said where we're going to be and when we're going to be, and then had some suppliers and some different people that we knew in the industry set up some tours and appointments and stuff for us. So our tour was not an organized and structured tour. It was kind of a little bit at our whim. We had places to be at certain times, and then other times we didn't have anything scheduled at all. And then I had never spent any extensive time in France, as in my entire three times I had been to France had been – or four times, five times, I don't know. It's been a few. But anyway, it had been flying in and out of the airport or going into Paris from the airport to change to the TGV and take that to a different country. So I had not spent any time at all in and around Paris or in France. So this was huge. I had a friend or someone in the industry look at me this last week and look at me and say, "Are you kidding me?" And I'm like, "No, I had never been to France before." And he's just like, "But Kimber, you're such a huge advocate of French wine." And I said, "Well, it's fabulous wine, and I've studied the regions, and I have done my fair share of drinking the regions, but I had never made the opportunity to go." So it was huge. It was absolutely huge. And I have to say thank you to the amazing French people who helped my friend and I get where we were trying to go. We had some amazing encounters, one of which I'll share with you today. So I am going to spend some time recapping my trip a little bit because I learned so much. Like I said, it was also kind of mixed in with vacation. So one day we went back and spent 3 days goofing off in Paris. And I probably won't talk about that so much. We had some great food and some great wine on the entire trip. That I think was probably one of the most amazing things, was the fact that the wine and food was just incredible, all of it. Absolutely phenomenal. I didn't have a bad meal, and that includes breakfast, which was often at the hotel we were staying at. That includes the random sandwiches that we had. We had more than one train station and plane airport kind of sandwich, and not one was something I wouldn't eat again, or I was disgusted with the quality. And I'm a little picky. I don't eat fast food. I don't eat according to American fare at all, as what most Americans probably are known for eating. I mean, I don't eat fast food. Let's just leave it at that. We won't even name names. You all know what those are. I don't eat those. I eat relatively healthy. You know, not perfect, but relatively healthy. So when we did the equivalent, what I would consider the equivalent, like the baguette sandwiches and stuff from some of the different places at the train stations and stuff, you know, you don't always expect a lot for that kind of sandwich. At least I didn't. And I was stunned every time. The food was just fantastic. All right, so I'm going to focus today on my trip to Rhône. Okay, R-H-O-N-E. And I have to be honest, the French people say it very different. I can't say it the way they do. I can't. So I'm going to focus on that. We got in the night before on Sunday evening. And, of course, everything's closed, so we come in on Sunday evening. And as we come in on Sunday evening, the train station pulls in. And you know, I had asked Anne when we were in Champagne how to get to this little town, and the girl couldn't even get it at the train station. She couldn't even get it to pull up. And I knew there was a stop there because I had extensively read and would extensively read more my rail timetables book that I bought of the entire European rail system, but the one that I was needing for this particular trip was the French section. So I knew there was a station where we needed to go, and I knew it was a little ways from our hotel. I didn't know how far, but I didn't book the hotel, so that wasn't my doing. And then I knew where we had to be to meet with Javelet, because that was the people who were going to take us on our amazing one tasting only, our amazing visit through the Rhône. So I only had one winery, so we get off the train, and it's gorgeous, okay? I have to be honest, the French weather quite disappointed me. It was way colder than the Weather Channel had said it was going to be, and it was rainy. It was supposed to be nearly sunny all but like 1 or 2 days, and it was rainy. I mean, yeah, gloomy and rainy. I've got these ominous clouds all through almost all my pictures. We get off the train in this small town in Rhône, and the weather's gorgeous. It's sunny. It's warm. I'm dressed too warm because we've been out walking around, and I'm in like a sweater and a wool cape that I have been so glad I brought with me to France because it's quite chilly. We get off the train, and the town is called Tonne-l'Hermitage, okay? And I know I'm still not saying it right. I'm doing about the best I can because my French is non-existent. I don't speak French. I've never studied French. I can read a couple of other languages, but I don't speak any of them well because of lack of practice. But French is not one I've even ever learned pronunciation, so I know that my French is not good. It's better, but I still know that it's not very good. But the town is called Tain-l'Hermitage, and it's T-A-I-N, Tain, and then L apostrophe, Hermitage, H-E-R-M-I-T-A-G-E. And you get off the train there, and I was so excited because I look up the hill as you get off the train, and there is the sign that says Jabalay. Paul Jabalet, and then the other one says Chapoutier, because apparently I believe they're the two largest landowners in Hermitage. They share some of that big, huge mountain. So we are supposed to be going to the La Chapelle Vineyard in Hermitage. It's a mountain, so on Hermitage works, with Jabalet on Monday morning. So this is Sunday night. We're getting into the train station. It's about 6. It's gorgeous, and I can't stop taking pictures at the train station on the platform up the hill. Because I'm telling Christy, who doesn't know Jabalet because she doesn't sell it. She works for a wholesaler, and I work for a retailer. So she doesn't know the wine. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, this is where we're going, up there. You know, and she takes a couple pictures, but she doesn't get it. And I'm like, no, that chapel up there, that's where we're going tomorrow. And I was just totally excited because these wines are amazing, as is everything that comes out of that region, whether it's Jabalet, which is where my tour was, but also Chapoutier, who owns the land there. I'm a big fan of their wines as well. As you all know, this is a favorite region of mine in the first place. So the excitement of getting to go there and see this major vineyard and not just taste the wines – but go to the vineyard, okay? I'm a bit of a dork. I'm a little wine geeky. I'm a little cork dorky, whatever you want to call it. I love to go see the soil because the soil, the terroir, that French word, terroir, that's what gives the wine its sense of place. That's what tells the story. And if I get enough time today to get through everything I want to tell you, then I'm going to do a little comparative thing at the end of someplace else that I went that grows some similar grapes and talk about the soil differences. Because that to me is what it's all about, is what's going on here, climate and soil and rain and all of those things that makes these grapes taste the way they do. Because, you know, when you're talking, the red grape they grow here is Syrah, all right? Syrah. Also known as Shiraz if you're in Australia. And sometimes there's people in other places that call it Shiraz. So same grape, two different – usually it's a style thing. Okay, the Syrah is a little more often, not always because nobody governs this. Coming out of the Rhone is going to be a little more earthy, a little more bacon fat, elegant, not as much black pepper. It'll be there, but it won't be as in your face. It'll usually use a French oak as well. If you're taking Shiraz from Australia, especially Barossa Valley, it tends to be filled with a lot more attitude, bigger, heavier, spicier, you know, all that sort of thing is what that would be. So just two totally different attitudes, two totally different expressions. And I love the Aussie Shiraz. I've been to Australia. I love their wine. So it's certainly nothing – it's just two different styles and both have their place. So this was an opportunity for me to kind of live a little bit of a dream because this was one of the most exciting places we went. So we get to Tonle Hermitage and it's like a town of 6,000 people. So there was a reason that girl didn't know that what it was even when I gave her the right spelling for the train station. She couldn't get it to pull up in all the way north in Champaign. She probably didn't even know what this town was because it's little. You're down south. You're not quite to Avignon. And then that further the train goes past Avignon and then the trains go over to like the Saint-Tropez and the really cool places along the Mediterranean where all the movie stars hang out. And then we had to not go that direction, though, because we were going from Montpellier. We were headed all the way west to Bordeaux was our next place that we were going to go after we finished up in Rhone at noon, 1 o'clock. The next place on our trip was Bordeaux. So we get to where we're going, and the place that my friend has booked as a hotel room is out of town. That's right. It's out of town. So we have to figure out how to get a cab. So there's a sign that says, you know, call a cab here. We call the first number. And he's like, oh, no, no cabs. Well, apparently his number's still everywhere, but maybe he doesn't do the cab business anymore because somebody tried to call him the next day too, and he said, no, no cabs. So it wasn't only us for no taxis. But I'm like, whoa, I just used my phone to make an extremely expensive phone call. And you're just telling me no taxis. So I was entertained. I really was. I refused to be frustrated. It was in a really great town. It was gorgeous outside for the first time since we'd left the States. You know what? We'll get there eventually. If not, I'm sure there's a hotel here down the street, and we'll just go there. So we call a different taxi. The train station tells us to call a different taxi, and we call a different company. They come and pick us up and take us out to where we're going. We get there. And it's a little bed and breakfast place. It's about 5 kilometers outside of town, so there's no place to eat. We're kind of stuck eating dinner there. And I'm hoping to remember the name or how to spell the name. I remember the hotel. I just don't remember how to spell the name. So I'm hoping to remember before the show's over so I can tell you where we stayed. So we decide, because all I have is like another Cliff Bar or two. This is not enough food for both Christy and I. So we decide we're just going to eat there. It's going to be expensive, but you know what? We'll eat here. It'll be good. And it was the best food that we had the entire trip. Okay, this is a little tiny place. There's, you know, nothing going on here. Absolutely nothing. It's really pretty outside. They had a beautiful garden. It did offer free Wi-Fi, which when we ask how to access the free Wi-Fi, they don't say it that way in France. They say it Wi-Fi. Which we didn't know that until the next day. So it's pretty funny. I'm like, oh, well, no wonder we couldn't communicate very well. So finally, my friend found it in her book because we were looking for the internet. And anyway, this place had some of the best food we had. I think it had the best food we had the whole trip. And all of our food was amazing. Remember, I already said that part. We both agree that this night was the best food that we had. He did that, and it was regional. And that's what I love. That's what I did in every town we were in until I got to Paris, was I ate whatever the regional specials were. Because every part of France is very big. Every part of France has completely different food and fare. So I tried to eat according to the region? You know, what are the things they would eat? What are the things they fix that are, you know, so if there was a thing about regional ham, you know, Savoy or a seasonal mustard or something like that that they were using in their preparation, then that's what I wanted to eat, because I don't go on vacation to eat what I can eat at home. I go out of town, no matter where I'm at. I want to eat the regional foods there. When I was in Belize last year, I ate everything that had to do with any type of seafood that was caught right there in the ocean. And whether it was sushi style or whether it was cooked and cooked their style, that's what I wanted to eat. Same thing here. This place was the best food that we had the entire trip. And it was a three-course meal, but we just opted out for dessert. And so we had first an escargot dish that was flat amazing. I mean, I'm glad we were going to share when we first started, sat down to start talking. We were going to share our food with each other. And we decided no, because we both love escargot. So I'm like, you know what? No, I'm going to have my own meal. And it was amazing. So here we are, the equivalent of middle of nowhere. And we're just having dinner there because there's no other choice. And it's the best food we have all vacation. You know, pretty cool, right? Pretty cool to be 5 kilometers outside of a little town, less than 6,000 people. 6,000 people, that's all that's in this little town. They didn't, probably nothing else was open, to be quite honest. I'm not even sure we could have had food somewhere else, because it was a sleepy little town when we got there at 6 o'clock on a Sunday. So we had dinner there, and the food, like I said, the food was amazing. We did breakfast there, too, because that was kind of included in our bed and breakfast. That's usually how that works. And then we leave and go down to our tasting. We get to our tasting at about 10 o'clock in the morning with Jabalay. So Hermitage, the hill, is called Hermitage because of a knight that came back from the Crusades, and he was in one of the Crusades, like 1200, okay? And he didn't want to be around people anymore. He just wanted peace. And, you know, and you can, I can get that. I mean, I've never been to war, but I can kind of get that. I can see where you just wouldn't want to have anything more to do. And so the queen, I believe it was, gave him of France, for his, you know, amazing service, gave him this mountain. And he became a hermit. Ah, see where this is going, right? And that's where it gets its name, Le Hermitage. Okay, so it was kind of, you know, the hermit, and it just became known after his name. And his name was Gaspard, I don't think that's the way you say it in French, de Starenberg. And Jabalay has a white blend that's in his honor that they call Knight of Starenberg, I think is what they call it. So that's about 1200 that was given to this knight, and he built the chapel up on the top and dedicated it to one of the saints, but I think St. Christopher. He dedicated it to the saint, and that's kind of what his dwelling was. And then at some point, people started planting grapes on this hill, okay? So we're going to get to that part, but people started planting grapes on this hill. And when we come back from break, I'm going to tell you what grapes they planted, and then I'm going to tell you about the amazing winemaker at Jabalay who took us on this tour up through these vineyards so I could play in the dirt. So we'll be right back.
For exciting video content live and on demand, visit www.voiceamerica.tv for exclusive content you just can't find anywhere else. That's voiceamerica.tv. Tune in now.
Do the adventures of Indiana Jones leave you curious about this exotic and unusual profession? If so, don't miss Indiana Jones: Myth, Reality, and 21st Century Archaeology with Dr. Joseph Schuldenrein. You'll learn about forensics, ancient civilizations, and human origins. Listen to Dr. Schuldenrein and colleagues discuss their excavations and related archaeological topics, ranging from the unique to the sublime, and yes, even the mundane. Indiana Jones: Myth, Reality, and 21st Century Archaeology, live Wednesday, 6 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, on Voice America Variety.
If you hear a dog barking or an angel singing, then you know that you're listening to Waking Up in America. Heard every Wednesday at 3 Pacific Time, Valerie Kirkhard and all of her friends will bring you powerful and humorous discussions that raise thoughts and give you insight on how to live your life to its fullest potential. Adventure is always a must on Waking Up in America with Valerie Kirkhard, every Wednesday at 3 Pacific.
News. Opinion. Your voice counts. Call toll-free 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-472-5787. VoiceAmerica.com.
are listening to Around the World in a Glass, presented by Sportsman's, with your host, Kimber Stonehouse. If you have a question for one of our upcoming programs, please send an email to aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. That's aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. Now, back to our show.
All righty, so we get to Jabalay. There's more excitement there, but you've had enough of my rambling today. So we get to Jabalay, which is in town, by the way, and not out where our hotel was. So we get in town. We get to Jabalay, Vineum, V-I-N-E-U-M, is their big tasting room. Well, it's closed on Mondays. So we have an appointment with Ralph, who is the winemaker. And if I remember it correctly, he's been winemaker at Jabalay since 2006. He came on right before harvest and has been making the wine for the last basically 7 years, 6 years, because we haven't harvested grapes yet this year. So 6 years. And he is going to be our guide to this hill. So we put our luggage away because, of course, we had to check out of the hotel again. We stayed in 8 different places in 9 nights. I've never been so happy to put my luggage in my apartment and not have to pick it up except to dump it and take everything out of it and clean it and put it away. I've never been so happy in all my life than when I got to do that. I was like, hallelujah, I don't have to pack this bag and lug it around anymore, at least not for a while. So we get there, and then we immediately go out, get in his car, and we begin to drive up to Hermitage, okay? And it's about 950 feet is the elevation there. Something like that. And we started out probably a little lower because it's right down by the river. There's the river, the Rhine River, that goes through Rhone, okay? And that is what divides it into two halves. And, you know, it divides it between, you know, where we were and then the opposite side, which is St. Joseph and Châteauneuf-du-Pape and stuff that are farther south. So it divides it in half. And then we'll talk a little bit more about that. So he takes us. So we're roughly not quite sea level, but probably 1 or 2 is the elevation. And then we go up to about 950 up at the top of the hill. We could have hiked it, but we didn't have enough time. And we were dressed kind of nice for hiking that. So he takes us in his vehicle all the way up to the top of the hill on these really quite narrow roads. And remember, I know I've told you about the German grapes that are terraced vineyards and so steep that they have to do everything by hand. Okay, this is the same thing. All right, so as we're going up, we see a horse plowing over on a different part of the hill. I hesitate to call it a mountain because I don't know if they call them mountains. So over on this hill, we see this horse in the distance that's plowing, and then as we go up to the La Chapelle part of the vineyard. And we head up there, we start to see, you know, other people working. So some, and they're working with, starting to do just a really hint little pruning is what they're doing in one vineyard. And in another, they're using organic approved things to deal with pests and fertilizer and stuff. So all organic approved because Jabalay on Hermitage, everything is done, I believe, 100% organic. And he was talking about the biodynamic concept, but they hadn't done that. And I don't know that they were planning to get certified. They were just thinking about starting to add some of that in. But he talked a lot about the organic process and how they treat the grapes and how they let the soil speak. You know, and I love that in a winery where they don't do too much processing because, to me, too much processing, you can make your wine in France taste the same as wine somewhere else, you know, and you want the wine to reflect its place. And they were very staunch supporters of that. So we drive up, and he lets us walk all the way up to the chapel. We stop many times to take pictures because Christy and I are big picture fans. So we took tons of pictures. And then we walk all the way up to the chapel itself and look in and then take some amazing pictures. And then Ralph takes the time then to talk about the soil differences and point out, you know, across the river over there, which we can look down and see the train station, by the way. So here I am standing where I took the pictures yesterday from the train station. So I have the pictures from both directions because, of course, I had to take a picture of the train station. But I look across at St. Joseph, and that's what he tells us it is. And it's a Guigal, which is cool because that was what Christy sells. Guigal has a property across the way that's one of their special vineyards of St. Joseph called La Hospices. And it's because of some hospitals that used to be there and are still there. And then they have the vineyards above it. And looking at it from the opposite side of the river, you're just like, are you serious? Those are vineyards? Because it just looks like switchback trails, you know, zigzaggy trails that you would hike. It doesn't even look like there's anything planted there. I mean, granted, we're early in the season, but it was that far away, and it was just that kind of steep. And I was just stunned to think that, you know, there's grapes over there. And then I get to looking at where I'm standing. And yes, there's grapes here too. And it was amazing to see, because these wines are expensive, all right? The wines that come off of the Hermitage, the La Chapelle and the La Petite Chapelle by Jabalay, $150 to $250, okay? $150 for La Petite, maybe a little less than that, $200 to $250 for the actual Hermitage, all right? They are expensive. Think Cote Rôti. Okay, Cote Rôti is also very expensive. And we've talked about that before on here, how amazing they are, but how they're going to set you back. It's a chunk of change. They are worth, in my opinion, every penny. And they're going to age well. You know, some longer than others, depending on the vintage and the style of the rain and, you know, all those sorts of things that go into it. But, you know, they're going to age well. You're going to get a good 10 years out of most years of an Hermitage before you drink it, probably maybe even more. But so we go up and we're looking at the soil and there's great big rocks because it's granite and gravel. The soil is granite and gravel. And finally, I looked at Ralph and I said, why would anybody ever plant grapes on this hill? It's steep. It's unmanageable. Nothing should grow here. Nothing should grow here. And these grapes, they thrive. I mean, they're old and they're gnarly, but I'm just stunned, you know, and it's 100% Syrah. That's all Jabalay has planted on the hill. And I think in fact, that's all that Chapoutier has planted up there as well is for reds, that's the only thing grown in Hermitage is Syrah. For whites, they grow Marzon and Ruzon. And for Jabalay, that's down at the base at Crow's Hermitage. And we're going to talk about that, too, if we can get there today. But I was just stunned as we're walking through because it's steep. Okay, and we're just, I mean, there are grapes planted alongside where we're walking up to the chapel. And, you know, and there's grapes below, and there's men working them. And, you know, and walking them. Nothing is motorized. There are cars to drive them up there, but nothing is done via, you know, motorized tractors, anything like that, because you can't put it on the hill. It's too steep. And then they're terraced, so they've got blocks of wall, kind of concrete, or not concrete, but blocks of rocks, big rocks, right? River rocks or non-river rocks, all made into like kind of like a fence and to sort it off. And then underneath that, say it'll be 4 foot tall, and then underneath that, you'd have the next sloping of vineyards. And so they call that terracing because you're blocking it off, and that prevents from erosion. That also takes some of the steepness out of the mountain because you can kind of build it up in one place, drop it down 4 feet, and then plant again, and then have another place where you just drop it down 4 feet. So it's a way to kind of level off a little bit of that steepness instead of just straight down the side. It was a pretty steep pitch. It wasn't 90 degrees, but it is pretty steep. I mean, I'm not very good at math, so you know, don't go with me. 90 degrees would be completely vertical, so it's going to be, depending on which side of the angle you're looking at, you know, maybe 100 if you're making it a wider angle. But, you know, you're looking at it and I'm like, why would anybody plant? So I ask Ralph, why would anybody plant grapes here? He's like, well, because the more fertile soil down at the base needed to be for things that were necessary and required to live. And wine grapes are not required to live. They are required for church wine. They are required for good wine. They are not required for living. Okay, that makes sense. The more fertile ground was down by the river, the better water was down by the river. It's a continental climate on that side of the Rhone, and they kind of get a little break. They're planted on the south side of the mountain. They kind of get a little bit of a break on Hermitage because it's a little farther south than, say, Cote Rôti. So still into the northern Rhone, of course, but doesn't get quite as cold there at this time of year. So their grapes don't have quite as much risk of frost. He said they did have more risk sometimes in the fall if they're slow to ripen. But it was just the coolest thing to stand there and see the steepness of the vineyards that I've read about and to see the wineries where I've read. And so we looked at the Syrah plants and we looked at the soil, which was really rocky, really gravelly, and then granite. Great big slabs of granite are mixed in with the soil. And I'm like, well, do the grapes struggle? You know, are they able to grow through the granite? And so he picked up some of the rock, and it's actually breakable. So if you hit it against another rock, it kind of breaks. So it's not as, say, tough for the grapes to grow through it like the limestone is in Coonawarra, in the Terra Rosa there, where you have the 2 foot of red dirt, and underneath it is this great big limestone bank, you know, and then the vines grow through the limestone down into the dirt below. Because I saw them when I was in Australia, and I was like, what? Because they had it kind of cut away. So you could see the 2 or 3 feet of the Terra Rosa, the red dirt, and then underneath it would be limestone. And then there are the vines going through the limestone into the dirt that's below the, you know, say 4 foot of limestone. And so he said, in this case, they don't have to do that because the rock will give to the strength of the vine eventually. So it doesn't, it kind of broke into chunks, which I thought was really cool. And the more we talked, we went and went down to Crow's Hermitage. So we spent some time up on the mountain there, and he pointed out the other regions and where, you know, Chateauneuf du Pape was, and just these different parts of Southern Rhone. And then he also told us that the river, I don't know how long ago, quite some time ago, had changed directions at one point, and not through man-made direction change, but through seismic activity, would be my guess. And he said that the Crow's Hermitage region at the base of the hill that we're going to next had rounded rocks. And that's how you knew that had once, and it was sandier. And that's how he knew that the river had once gone around the opposite way around the Hermitage Hill. So here we are up on this hill and looking down, and he's like, and that river right there used to go around the base the opposite direction. And that's why they plant mostly whites in Crow's Hermitage with Marzahn and Ruzahn. And Jabalay and Chapoutier own a lot of that as well. But so we went down that and did that next, and we saw the difference in the grapes and the soil. And I put, you know, I had the soil in the hands, and you could feel the sandiness, and you could see the rocks. They were rounded from being tumbled to the river. So here there are these rocks of different sizes, and they're river rocks, you know, smooth all around the edges. And then the rocks that we saw up on the hill were all sharp edges because, of course, the river had never flowed over the hill. The hill was, you know, separate. So we went down after we did all of this, and, you know, and I've mentioned before that, like, Cote Rôti, and I asked Ralph, I said, so is it true? Because, you know, you read stuff, right? I read a lot. And sometimes I think, seriously, do they do that? Oh, I had the opportunity to ask. So I ask, do you really cart the dirt back up at the end of the year, or if it's a rainy year, do you cart the dirt back up to the top to prevent erosion? Because I know they do that in Cote Rôti. I've read that they do that at Hermitage. Do you do that? I don't know. It seems kind of weird to me. And he looked at me and he goes, yes, we do. I'm like, really? He goes, especially if it's a really rainy year? Yes, we do. We catch it down at the bottom in a drain and we haul it back up to the top to prevent the erosion of the soil into the river. He goes, that topsoil is our lifeline to making these wines. I was stunned. You know, because, again, I'm a dork. I know it. I'm like, oh, my God. It's true what I read in the book. Because I don't know. I always wonder. I always wonder that. It's just, are you serious? They really do that? Even now? I mean, they might have done that 50 years ago, but they do that now? And so when we're driving down to, we go down the hill, and we're driving to Crow's Hermitage to look at the white wine grapes, Marzahn and Ruzahn, because I was, again, asking questions about Marzahn and Ruzahn, because those are not favorite grapes of mine. And I said, why not? And which one is it that I really don't like? I'll get to that in a minute, I promise. So, because that was a huge answer for me. I usually dislike both of those grapes, but the problem is they're almost always blended together. So which one don't I like? And I have the answer finally. So anyway, as we're driving down to that other vineyard, Ralph stops. And he says, that's the drain where we collect the dirt. And I'm like, are you serious? And he's like, yeah, that's the drain. So I get out, of course, and I take this picture of this concrete drain that they've got. And it's not like a culvert like we would have here where it's a rounded drain. It's just these sets of concrete sections. And it looks like it just kind of drains off the mountain. And as it drains through the different sections, it filters out everything except the dirt. And the dirt kind of goes through. And then when the dirt gets very much down at the bottom, they take it up back up to the top of the hill. Coolest thing ever. I'm like, oh my God, there's the drains where they collect the dirt. How awesome is that? And then we walked over to Crow's Hermitage, and he had us walk about, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile, maybe a little bit more, up into the vineyard. Maybe a little more. Might have been a half a mile. I don't know. Didn't seem like that far. And you think you're kind of level. A little slant, but not big. You get up to where he had us stop and turn around. And we had come up quite a ways, actually. But because it wasn't as steep as actually being on the hill of La Chapelle, and actually the big hill of Hermitage, you didn't realize it. It looks, when you're at the base, and even when we park there, it looks like it's relatively level, but it was not level. And so these are still all tended by hand. Nothing goes through there that's going to be a whole lot of machinery. They did have a little thing that they were using to do some spraying that was like the equivalent of like a little bitty lawnmower, or maybe a little more narrow, that went through and was spraying probably sulfur because that's an organic treatment they can do. But it was something organic that they were allowed to use. And we just kind of stayed out of the way because don't want to smell like that, thanks. But it was a, like a little narrow lawnmower size. Okay, so a riding lawnmower that you would have here in the States, only even more narrow than that. And that's what they were using to go back up and down the rows. Very small, little short sections. The other thing that we saw that was just amazing to me was when we were up on the hill, they were using this winch thing to basically till the soil. Okay, so keep in mind, everything has to be done by hand. And it can't be done, you know, there's not a lot of machinery up there. So this is a little winch. It was relatively small. And they would toss it down, say, 15 to 20 feet down to the terrace level for whatever row it was. And one man would hold it and steady it so it would actually till the dirt. And the other man would be at the top and run the winch. And so it would kind of pull the little plow thing, the little till thing, up. And he would steady it and keep it down in the dirt. Otherwise, it would just kind of scoot across the top because it wouldn't have any resistance. So he provided the resistance. And then he'd get up the 15 to 20 feet. They'd move it over to the next row, drop it down to the base, and then head that steepness right back up the next side. And that's what they would do. So every bit of the work done on these grapes is done by hand. Okay? Yes, they're using a winch to help plow and till. They're not using an actual hoe. You know, H-O-E. But it's still very labor intensive. When you think that they get off of this hill and in this little region less than 700,000 bottles annually. 700,000, that's not very much for as much work goes into this wine. And some of that's the white stuff. There's a reason. And that's all the producers. That's not just Jabalay. That's Jabalay, Chapoutier, and any of the other little producers. Because there was a few little ones. Mostly the entire thing is owned by Jabalay and Chapoutier. The majority of it. I mean, big majority. I was stunned, okay? That region, Hermitage, was established by the French AOC in 1937. Okay, so that's how relatively new that was. Before that, they used to talk about Bordeaux wines being Hermitaged. No, they used to add a little Syrah in to make the Bordeaux bigger until the AOC came in and established the guidelines, and then they weren't allowed to do that. They're not allowed to do that anymore. But I thought that was pretty funny. I'm like, oh, I've read about the wines being Hermitaged, but that's been quite some time ago. All right, so we've talked about, I'm looking at my notes real quick, Marzahn and Rizahn. So we go down, we see these two different vineyards. They're totally different in, you know, you can see why they're all considered roughly the same region, Hermitage and then Crow's Hermitage, but the soil was so different, and that's a classification thing. When the soil's that different, it's considered a different region. AOC, American AVAs, same thing, whether you're talking wine of origin from South Africa. Those are the reasons why. So then the next thing we did after we go down, after we take the tour at both of these vineyards, so we go down and we're going to do our tasting at Vineum. All right, so when we come back from break, we're going to talk about that.
The Internet's number one talk station. Number one talk station. VoiceAmerica.com.
Tune in every week for Sex Out Loud. Host Tristan Taramino will discuss everything from sexual pleasure to sexual politics. Get an insider's perspective from leaders in the adult film industry, the LGBT community, and the sex-positive world. From kink to non-monogamy, nothing is off-limits. Plus, you can call in to join the conversation. Sex Out Loud airs every Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Each week, Jimmy Gould brings you the stories and the people that you want to hear about. Tune in to A Current Life to hear about the journey to success, how our guests became the people they are today, and the highs and lows they experienced along the way. Each hour will leave you inspired and entertained as Jimmy gets up close and personal with every week's guest and shares ideas you can identify with and apply to your own life. A Current Life with Jimmy Gould airs Fridays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, noon Pacific Time, on the Voice America Variety Channel.
Streaming live, the leader in Internet talk radio, VoiceAmerica.com. You are listening to Around the World in a Glass, presented by Sportsman's, with your host, Kimber Stonehouse. If you have a question for one of our upcoming programs, please send an email to aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. That's aroundtheworldinaglass@hotmail.com. Now, back to our show.
All right. So we are coming back down to taste. Okay. We're coming back down to taste the wines that Ralph has spent, you know, years now making. A friend of mine was quite envious. I'm going to tell this quick story here. When I said the Jaboulet appointment came through the Friday before we left for France. Okay, so we're leaving on Tuesday, and we're not getting into France until Wednesday-ish, Thursday-ish. And Friday morning, I get the email saying that Jaboulet has confirmed an appointment. And I'm just blown away because it says in the email that we're going to La Chapelle Vineyard. And I'm like, oh, my God. You know, I'm just so excited. And I'm a lot like a six-year-old. Okay, I was a lot like a six-year-old that week before we left because appointments, several appointments fell into place right at the last minute. And I didn't even know about some of the appointments that we still had in the bank coming in Bordeaux because my friend that set those up didn't tell me anything that was going on there. So she just said we had appointments all day, which that was awesome. I'm here to taste wine. I don't care, you know, whose wine at this point. I just want to be here. They came through, and I was like a six-year-old at Christmas time, like a week before Christmas, 2 weeks before Christmas, just because it was, this is an amazing vineyard. I've sold these wines for years. I've read about this. I've read about this place. And here I am. I'm going to go. So not only am I, you know, and then it wasn't just the tasting. The tasting was very cool and was amazing, of course. But I'd had the wines before, not all of them, but most of them. For me, the excitement was seeing the vineyard, seeing why the grapes taste the way they do, why they have the flavor profile that they have, seeing the workers in the vineyard. Because it's one thing, honestly, it's one thing to read about it and to read reputable books, because that's what I read. I read really good quality books. I'm not reading, you know, the equivalent of a fiction book about my wine. I'm reading people who've probably been there. I would assume they've been there. Most of them are very well traveled, but I'm reading reputable authors. But it's different. You go, you stand up there on that hill, and you see those workers doing everything by hand. I mean, we saw some women in the Chapoutier vineyards going through and hand pruning. 100% by hand. Little bitty, and Ralph told us what they were doing. Little bitty vines that aren't going to grow grapes and are just going to basically suck up the energy. So they go through and they prune off the two or three little ones at the bottom so they only have so many shoots per vine. And so they get them off at the base because as the base comes up and they have the shoots they want, then they're going to go ahead and prune the little ones that keep growing as the season goes. And so there were a couple of women out in the Chapoutier vineyards and that's what they were doing. And he says, we're not quite ready to do that. That'll probably be in the next week or so. And I was like, oh my gosh, to be here and to see it and to do it. I mean, I had the same experience when I was in Australia. And then I had the same experience once in Napa, where I went and actually worked in the vineyard. Well, I don't think we actually worked. We did a little bit of work. She had us count some grapes and stuff like that. But it was pretty easy for working in the vineyard for our afternoon. But we did, you know, just got to observe and be out there and see the dirt and see the grapes and see where they were and then do some sugar testing and stuff like that. And it's just such an amazing opportunity as a wine aficionado. So we get back to the tasting room. And Ralph has had his assistants helped him. And he wasn't happy with the selection we had. So we go over and he goes and pulls a few more whites because I had been asking questions about Marzon and Ruzon. And these are just two grapes that are many, many times I don't like them. I don't enjoy drinking them. And for several reasons. Sometimes they're somewhat heavily oaked. And as you know, I'm not a big fan of oak. I want to taste the grapes. I don't want to taste wood. If I wanted toothpicks, I would eat toothpicks. And that's just personal preference. I want to taste the elegance of the grapes. I want to taste the grapes and where they're from. So when I drink Chablis, I want to taste the limestone and the chalk that's in that soil. When I drink Champagne, I want to taste that chalk that's in those underneath that soil. When I'm drinking Kunawara Reds, I want to taste the Terra Rosa that's there and the dirt. You know, I'm the same thing if I'm drinking a California Cab. I want to taste the Rutherford dust if it comes from Rutherford. I want that. I want that flavor profile. I want to taste what I need to taste with an Oregon Pinot. If it's coming out of Willamette, there's a certain flavor profile that should be there, and I want that. So to be there and to absorb that is what I was, you know, really into. And I told Ralph, he said, I have had many Marzahn Ruzahns. I don't know which one it is I don't like, because sometimes I have Ruzahn and I hate it. But it's almost always heavily oaked. And he goes, well, let's, you know, he goes, they didn't pull enough whites, and we've talked a lot about whites. So he goes and grabs a couple bottles of white, and one of them is the Knight de Starenberg bottling of their Marzahn Ruzahn from the Crow's Hermitage Vineyard. So it's a very special bottling of Jabalay white. And I'd have brought a bottle home, except it was early in the trip, and it was a little price prohibitive for my budget. And besides, my luggage was already too heavy to carry without two or three bottles of wine in it. So we taste these two whites. And I'm like, this is fantastic. And one of them kind of had some floral notes. And I ask him, you know, what is it I'm tasting and what is I'm liking and not liking here? And so he gives me the description of the two grapes. And the Ruzahn is actually the lighter of the two grapes. It has, you know, some good acidity. It has some maybe hints of floral notes. It's just a really good light white. And the Marzahn is the one providing the depth and the weight and the sometimes the oiliness that comes into this blending. Okay, I got that. I said, but why do I not like Ruzahn then? Because there are times I don't like Ruzahn. What is happening when people make Ruzahn? Because it can be straight varietal, and I flat don't like it. And I'm not going to name any names because it's just me. Okay, I'm just picky, and I know that. So what is it I'm not liking? And so he starts talking about Ruzahn as a grape. It can be overripe, and then you lose the acidity, and you lose the structure. Okay, bingo, right there. That's one reason I'm not going to like it. He goes, it's a lot like Viognier. And when it gets overripe, it becomes flabby, no acid, kind of all fruit, but not really good fruit. He goes, the other thing they do is to hide their ineptness with Ruzahn. Many people use a lot of oak. They think that it needs a lot of oak, and what the oak does is it overwhelms the grape. Bingo number two, right there. Because when I like Viognier, it's elegant and beautiful. It can be heavily oaked like it would be in a Cote Rôti or a Condru where it has more oak, but it needs to be French oak, and it needs to just be creating the roundness in the backdrop. I can't overwhelm the Viognier. And then the other problem I have with Viognier is sometimes there's just no structure. And I'm like, what is wrong with this wine? I love this grape. Or I hate this grape. There seems to be no middle of the road for me. Ruzahn is the same kind of grape. It's hard to pick it at the right moment. If you give it too much hang time, it gets overripe and it loses its acidity. It's a thin, I believe it was a thinner skin grape. So that means already less tannin and less structure. So you can't rely on that. You've got to get it by picking it at exactly the right moment in time. And if it gets too ripe, you get too much sugar and it makes the grape and the wine very flabby because you don't have it balanced with the acid. And then to mask that, a lot of people will start to oak it. And the oak just overwhelms the poor little grape. So I was so excited to have that answer to my questions. And then he pours for us these two different whites. And one of them was the Knight de Starenberg. That was their special one that they do in honor of the hermit that lived there. It was flat amazing. He poured another one too, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember the name of it. It's probably in one of my pictures because I liked it too. But the Knight de Starenberg was the one that was just like, oh, holy cow, I need to take this home. This is really good. I'm trying to get some here in Phoenix, but we don't get very much. But I'm hoping to lobby to get some here for next year. Just, you know, I only want six bottles. I only want a case just to have it because it was such an amazing bottle of wine. And the Marzahn and the Ruzahn together were beautiful. The Marzahn provided the structure on the back, and then the Ruzahn was just beautiful on the top. It just delicately laid on top, and they kind of interwove a little bit so that you had just this beautiful aroma, and then it went through the mouth, and you had all the structure and acidity along the side, and then it went down the back palate and just had a beautiful long finish that just lingered and lingered and lingered. So then I mentioned that it had some kind of floral aromatics. And he's like, yeah, it can. You can. That's certainly there. And I said, you know, kind of reminds me a little bit of Viognier. And we were talking about the quality and everything of the grape. And so he went and got a bottle of Viognier. And, of course, it was a Condru. And opened that up so we could try that side by side. And as we went through the tasting, we tasted some of the less expensive things, the Parallel 45s that you can find at the grocery store. These wines are dynamite. They do them in I believe it's a white blend, but we didn't taste that day. And then a rosé that is absolutely flat, amazing, should be under $15 on your shelf at the grocery store. I don't know if they carry the rosé or which grocery stores would, but if you're seeing the rosé out, it's called Parallel 45 because that's the line for the latitude. And that rosé is fantastic, okay? It might be a little less than 15. I'm giving you a ballpark because I don't know what things cost in all markets. On our shelf, it would be $13, $14. So that rosé was flat awesome. And then they do a red blend that was my first introduction to Chablis many, many years ago when I got in the wine industry working at World Market. And the Parallel 45, it was just fantastic. It was one of my favorite wines to sell because it was just really good bang for your buck and a great way to introduce people to French wine because it had plenty of fruit that it wasn't too austere, but it wasn't jammy and it wasn't sweet and it was just elegance in a bottle and it went fantastic with everything. And that's how I feel about it still. It goes fantastic with most foods. The rosé goes fantastic here in Phoenix in the summer. It's just a perfect summer coiffure. And I drank rosé while I was in France. I probably drank rosé 50% of the time. 25% of the time I drank white, and maybe the other 25 to 30 I drank red. So Christy was a big fan of red, and I said, look, we're not buying a bottle tonight because I'm tired of drinking red. We've drinking red for 2 days. I'm going to drink my white. I like white, and I love rosé. And where else would you want to drink it? I mean, the rosés in France are amazing. The first night we were there, I had rosé with my dinner, and server came out and he's like, I said I wanted the rosé, and because I'm American and he had already figured that out, it's not hard, it kind of comes out of my mouth quite clearly, he's like, oh, you want the demi-sec? And I'm like, no, I don't. I want the one from Provence. I don't want the demi-sec. I don't want the sweet one. Just because I'm an American doesn't mean I want white Zin. I want the Provence. I want the Provence rosé because it's going to be beautiful. All right, so we tasted through those less expensives, and then we went on into the amazing wines that Chablis is known for, the high-end things, several of them. And then we got to Petite Chapelle. He opened a Cote Rôtie because we were discussing the fact that the La Chapelle, Petite Chapelle, was 100% Syrah, but yet there were some floral notes on it. And he said that's just from, you know, just from the terroir, and that just happens with that grape and Syrah in that region. And I mentioned that it was similar to what I knew they added the Viognier to Cote Rôtie. And he's like, our Cote Rôtie is actually 100% Syrah, but let's try it anyway. And so he opened yet another bottle of wine for us. The visit that I had and the flavors I got to taste and seeing the soil and understanding now, you know, seeing it in action was just huge for me. And hopefully you're getting that from my conversation today, because I was stunned at the work that went into that vineyard, knowing it and reading it and then watching it. You know, it was hot. It was early March or early May. I'm sorry. It's only May. I was stunned at watching them traipse up and down those hills. And I was like, this is a lot of work. And there was, you know, maybe 10 people out working the vineyard that we saw. There's probably more, but that's what we saw on that one set of hills and then down, of course, on Creux Hermitage. And it was just amazing to see how hard it was, how labor-intensive it was, and then to go back and try the wines. And yeah, there's a reason La Petite Chapelle costs $140 or $150 on the shelf. There's a reason Hermitage is more expensive. And when you look at how little they produce and how hard they have to work to maintain those grapes, it's just flat amazing. If you get the chance to go to Rhone, make sure you take time to stop into Chablis and try their wines. And that was one of the things Ralph said as he ran us to the train station to frantically catch our next train, was so few people stop and actually taste. And I mean, and we were both wine aficionados, so we had millions of questions and, you know, and wanted to ask more questions. And, you know, he was such an amazing host and really, really told us about the vineyard and let us see it in action and feel the soil and see the rock and see the granite that was there. And, you know, and answered sometimes even maybe our dumb questions or not so intelligent questions, because I'd never been someplace quite like that. And, you know, and his English was very good, by the way. We just really enjoyed that visit. And like I said, we'll have more of these shows next week. Maybe I'll try to figure out if I can condense Bordeaux into one day. And I do want to tell you about my amazing trip in Champagne. We had some amazing people who helped us along our way. And the staff at the train station at Tannes-l'Hermitage was amazing for us. I'm not going to tell you everything they did, but they helped us get on our way. And they didn't need to do that. They didn't have to do that. They went over and above what a train station person should do and helped us get rerouted and figure out, because I had made a mistake in reading the train schedules and thought one town that the train station was in the same building, and it was across town from each other. And so we couldn't make our transfer. And they made it to where we could get where we needed to go a little bit late, but within an hour. So if you get the chance to go to Rhone, make sure you take time to go to Chablis and make sure you taste the wines there at Vinium. The wines are amazing. Take the time. It's well worth your effort to taste them and to see, just see what they have to offer. It was amazing. Again, Tannes-l'Hermitage, it's got a train station, even if they don't remember it in Champaign at the train station. It's got a train station. Only comes through there about once an hour, maybe less. And the wines are fabulous. Town about 6,000, so really do your mapping well and know that you may need a cab if you're going to go anyplace very special. And that hotel, if I remember it, I will pop it into my notes or I will tell you next week because I've got to find it. I can't find it. There's two or three spelled the same way, and I want to make sure I get you the right one with the amazing food. And anyway, we'll be back next week. I had an amazing time. I am still getting over that stupid cold, but not much longer now. We still have Bordeaux and Champagne and my wonderful traipsing around Vougeot because we're a little bohemian, so we just kind of got off the train when it looked cool. All right, until next week, have a glass of Rhone, check out Jaboulet, and we'll see you next time. Cheers.
Thanks again for tuning in. Around the World in a Glass is heard every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Variety Channel. Please join Kimber Stonehouse from Sportsman's Fine Wines and Spirits next week for another glass.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program brought to you on the Voice America Variety Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericavariety.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the hosts or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.